Welcome to the final session of Tech Days Online. My name's Steve Thayer. I'm the CTO of DevOps Guys and a Microsoft Regional Director. And it's my pleasure today to wrap this whole thing up by sitting down and having a conversation with Gene Kim. I'll get Gene to introduce himself in a minute, but obviously if you've never heard of Gene, he's the author of the Visible Ops Handbook, the the Phoenix Project, and we've got the DevOps Handbook, two seminal books on DevOps, and we've had some fascinating presentations over the course of the last 3 days on technical topics, on open source topics, and on just sort of incredible future technology in Bitcoin and AI and all sorts of stuff. And I think DevOps for me sits at this intersection of all of these things. So we thought it was a really great opportunity to sit down, have a conversation with Gene, and really try and bring some of this stuff together. So, Gene, can you start by giving a little bit of background on yourself and your research that led to these books and that journey that you've been on?
Oh, brilliant. And Stephen, thanks for having me join you. My journey started of studying high-performing technology organizations since 1999, and that's a journey that started back when I was the CTO and founder of a company called Tripwire in the information security space. And you can imagine in that 18-year journey, there were many surprises, but by far the biggest surprise was how it took me into the DevOps movement, which I think is so urgent and important. I agree with you that it really is at the center of so many revolutions going on right now. So I left Tripwire in 2010 and spent the next 3 years co-authoring the Phoenix Project, which is really meant to describe kind of what does this downward spiral look like that DevOps was really the intervention for. And more recently, I worked with Patrick Dubois, John Willis, and Jez Humble to put out the DevOps Handbook, which is really meant to be that nonfiction companion guide to describe how do great organizations, what are the principles and patterns that enable the outcomes that we associate with DevOps. And incidentally, a little bit of trivia for everyone out there that Steve and I go back, 5 years, and we met when we would be tweeting haikus at each other at conferences. I think we started at the Velocity Conference in Santa Clara.
2012, yeah. That's a long time ago now. So, in the book and in your research and your speaking, we talk a lot about you talk to a lot of organizations that are trying to implement DevOps approaches. What do you think are the biggest challenges that you see them facing? And, what's your favorite case studies for sort of end-to-end DevOps transformations?
So there are 48 case studies in the DevOps Handbook. It's probably the reason why I was more than 5 years late. But, what I love about them is that there's certainly some case studies from, for example, Amazon and LinkedIn and Google, talking about what led to service orientation at Amazon, what led to the full embracing of automated testing at Google, what led to re-architecture at LinkedIn. But, that's only probably about 8 or 9 of those stories. The rest of the stories are really dominated by large, complex organizations that have been around for decades or, even over a century, really describing how did the DevOps journey began at Nordstrom, a large U.S. retailer, or at Target, another retailer, Capital One, a global bank. And so I think what is so marvelous to me is that, or Disney, in terms of their embedding ops engineers into the lines of business, into the dev teams. So I love those case studies are all my favorites, all 48 of them. If I were to pick three. Certainly, I think the birth of automated testing at Google is one of them. The fact that in 2005, deploying to Google.com was actually a very dangerous activity. It was like the dumping ground of a whole bunch of teams just putting very poorly tested code on there, and it would rarely result in an outage, but this would certainly result in, slow searches, incorrect searches, and so forth. And Mike Bland described at the DevOps Enterprise conference about how essentially they drew a line in the sand and said there will be no more code accepted and promoted into production unless there was automated testing along with it. And so I think that's one of the common obstacles that faced every organization, right? DevOps is is predicated on many things, including version control, but also testing, right? You can't get these velocity measures without being able to have assurance.
It's the pivot point that for me, when I think of DevOps, is if you think DevOps as a pipeline, testing is that pivot point, like on a seesaw or a kid's teeter-totter in American, that's the fulcrum that everything moves on. And if your test automation story is not strong, you can't move at velocity. I mean,
absolutely. And now as an organization that's doing, nearly 10,000 code commits per day, right, deploying, multiple times a week, for some of the largest properties in the world, right, clearly that's, exemplifies exactly what you're talking about. I guess one other case that I really love is Nordstrom, just because it started off so differently. They started in three places in this retailer, certainly the e-commerce area, but the two are so unlike the unicorn stories of Facebook, Google, Amazon. They started in their in-store cafeteria systems and also their, one of their mobile apps. And essentially they gained such confidence with that over 3 years that Courtney Kistler described how 3 years into the journey, they actually baked it into the executive bonus compensation plans. No one could get their bonuses unless they could show a 20% lead time reduction for all customer-facing properties. So, and there's a quote about how it started, which really came from a board of directors meeting at Nordstrom. And they said, it started when the board of directors looked at three other retailers, Barnes & Noble, Borders, and Blockbusters, and said, how do we avoid becoming one of them?
Wow.
And that was really the shift from optimizing technology for cost and really optimizing for speed. So, I think these are relevant to almost every organization out there, every industry vertical.
Yeah, I mean, just to pull two things out of that, I think, first of all, you said, this was being discussed at board level, which I think is fascinating. And the second thing is in the Google case study, you said that he mandated that it could not go to production without automated testing. And I'm sort of skipping around some of our list of questions here, but it's a topic that's fascinating me. That to me, that's some real digital leadership. That's some real DevOps leadership. It's this top down, that to go with the bottom up excitement from the techies who want to use the tools and the cloud and all this sort of stuff. I mean, would you say that all of those case studies have had that inspirational leader or that Damascus moment for the senior leadership to really get their weight behind it? I mean, how critical is that senior leadership input?
Well, I think very critical. And so I've been running this conference called the DevOps Enterprise Summit, which is really focused on the technology leadership who is driving this transformation. It's not the highest levels of leadership, right? I mean, the titles are typically director of operations, chief architect, director of development. And so I think these are the second or third line leaders, so for managers, senior managers, directors. And so I think what's in common to those is that they're close enough to the work where they're very attuned to the modern technology practices and the architecture required to get these amazing attributes. What they all have in common is a certain level of courage. I mean, I think they were given some degree of support from upper management. I think all of them wildly exceeded the support they were given, essentially putting themselves into some degree of personal jeopardy. And so when you ask the question, why would they do that? I think what they all have in common is a sense of utter clarity and conviction that the capabilities they're creating for their organization is required to not just win in the marketplace, but to even survive in the marketplace. And so, I think it's a very interesting population of people who are driving these transformations. Just one last comment on this. We were talking about this before. At the DevOps Enterprise Summit in London last June, we had Ron von Kamenada, the CIO of ING Bank, talk. Mm. And so, he leads an organization of 8,000 to 9,000 engineers, broadly classified as dev, test, and operations. Mm-hmm. And yet, talked to him, he said, back in 2011, we were the company in the Phoenix Project. He said we had the worst rated mobile app in the App Store. He said the only reason it wasn't worse is that you actually can't give 0 stars. And that was that Damascus moment you're talking about where he said we knew we had to change. And he said there was a third line manager who said, I have a proposal on a better way to do things, right? And that was actually really the birth of the departure from birth from waterfall-like processes to what is clearly an agile cloud journey.
Yeah, I mean, that's a, I think the importance of agile and an agile approach is, I think is really fascinating. I mean, personally, I don't think you can do, I don't think you can do DevOps in a waterfall world. I also think that there's some interesting stuff happening at the moment with the sort of the open source community has been running, you know, large scale distributed open source projects for many years. Okay, they've had varying levels of success, some amazingly successful products like Linux, some, you know, less successful little projects that never go anywhere. But, you know, this idea of enterprise open source or inner source, I mean, do you think that there are some great lessons that that organizations can take from the open source movement in doing distributed collaboration and agile at scale?
Oh, yeah, clearly. I mean, I think you know, there are, there's a philosophical argument technique. It's like the existence proof. The fact that they exist, you know, shows that it can be done.
Yeah.
And I think Capital One, ING Bank, you know, these are all organizations that are adopting open source first, cloud first, just like Netflix has. And, you know, I think what's interesting, I think maybe you and I were talking at the at Velocity London in 2011. We were asking, why is it that you always see these people from Etsy and Netflix and you know, certain organizations just kept on showing up? And right behind us in line for coffee in the morning was Michael Rimbetzi, you know, who was at that time the director of operations at Etsy. And we asked him, and he's, you know, why do people keep showing up at these conferences? And he said it's actually baked into the engineering performance reviews, that every engineer is required to either write a blog post, you know, three times a year, or go to a tech conference and give a talk, or contribute to open source. And I think as organizations say that in order to win in the marketplace, we need to build a world-class technology organization, you know, these are the same sort of practices that we're going to be adopting, right? So I think there's so many forces that are causing every technology organization in the same down the same path that we saw in the web scale companies.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting getting. I'm gonna jump around the questions a bit, but in every, you're talking there about Etsy's culture and the way they incentivize their people to share, you know, a critical part of, you know, culture, automation, lean metrics, sharing, the CALMS model of DevOps. You know, in every presentation I see on DevOps, they start their presentation with DevOps is about culture, and then they spend 45 minutes talking about automation. But, you know, you know, I think that you know, DevOps is a cultural thing. But what does DevOps culture mean to you, Gene Kim? What are the characteristics of a successful DevOps culture to you?
Yeah, in fact, I was reading your blog post about that this morning, and I thought it was very provocative. Yeah, I'll tell you what DevOps culture means to me. I think some of the most provocative and the place where I learned the most co-writing the DevOps handbook was it's really organized around the principles around the three ways: flow, feedback, and that culture of continual experimentation learning, and then practices that enable them. But it was all around the third way, around culture, that I continually felt like I didn't know enough, right, to actually be, you know, contributing to the book. And I think one of the most riveting stories for me, there were two stories. One was, it was actually at the typical General Motors plants where they, you know, workers at the assembly line, in the manufacturing plant, would routinely allow, you know, engines to be sometimes put in backwards, right, you know, to essentially the cars that were coming off the end of the line, you know, had to be towed away because they couldn't actually run. And so it's not like, and there was a line in this book called The High Velocity Edge, written by Dr. Steven Spear. And he said, you know, it was really, this is the fault of leadership, right? Is that people knew that there was a better way, but they didn't create the conditions where people were enabled to actually improve the system.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so in contrast, you know, consider Paul O'Neill, the CEO of Alcoa, a large aluminum manufacturer. And he said, you know, the most important thing as he became CEO was workplace safety. He wants zero accidents, certainly zero fatalities. And this was at a time when there was 2% of the workforce were being injured. And he put in his policy that says every time that someone gets hurt on the job, I want to know about it within 24 hours. And the person who's going to tell me about it is the business unit president. And it wasn't this top-down micro surveillance initiative. It really was saying, you know, this is important, you know, to him personally. They reduced the workplace accident rate from 2% down to 0.2%. I'm sorry, to 0.02%. And so what did he do next? He said, now I want to be notified of any near miss. and so in my mind, this is exactly sort of the culture norms we see that allow these kind of amazing improvements that we see in DevOps work patterns, where we have blameless postmortems, not just on customer impacting incidents, but eventually team impacting incidents. Mm-hmm. You know, because we need to, if we run out of outages to learn from, well, then we have to either tighten up our tolerances so that we learn from anything that goes wrong, or we actually deliberately inject faults to create outages, like, you know, Chaos Monkey and so forth. So, in my mind, that, yeah, exactly right. And I think that that relentless need to learn, validates this. Line from academia, you know, said, I think it was Peter Senge who said, the organization that win in the marketplace are the ones that outlearn the competition. And so I think that that was really in my mind.
So one of my fellow RDs, Simon Sabin, makes a big point about being a data-driven. He comes from a SQL Server and data background, makes a big point about being data-driven and metrics-driven. Yeah. And if you can do one, in the previous call we're on, if you can do one thing is create a metric for yourself. You know, it's something that's gonna drive your behavior, that's gonna move you forward and say, I'm gonna beat that score or that thing. The one thing I would say about that is a lot of, and to your point about feedback loops in the third way, is that there are many, many metrics that people look at that are purely output metrics. You know, and output metrics are not necessarily the best metrics. You know, if the metric doesn't tell you something about the process, Deming would say, you know, 95% of an individual's success or failure is governed by the process in which he operates. So, you know, how do you create metrics that feed back into the process and give you insight into the process, not just simple output metrics?
Long answers, but, you know, I think that one of the areas that you and I, one of the common areas of passion we have is, you know, what are the marks of those leadership patterns? And there was a friend of mine, now Dr. Stephen Maynor, he actually rattled off what he thought the attributes were. And when I heard it, my jaw dropped, because he said with such precision, you know, what the attributes that I've observed over many years. And, you know, the model that he was reciting from is called transformational leadership. So it's kind of an offshoot of servant leadership. Mm-hmm. But he said there's really four things that are required. One is intellectual stimulation that needs to challenge status quo and encourage followers to learn. The second is empower decision making. The second was inspirational motivation, the ability to paint a path that others want to follow. The third is individualized consideration, the notion of, you know, helping learners learn, you know, offering support for their team. And then the third is idealized influence, being a good role model, being a lifelong learner. Mm. And, you know, so we actually, there's an assessment instrument called the MLQ, that multi-leadership questionnaire. We actually, as an experiment, we actually ran that across 100 of the people who presented at DevOps Enterprise. And, you know, the interesting finding is they all self-identified, you know, as, you know, caring about these four things. So, you know, it's just very, I think this gives us some confidence that, you know, there really is some underlying patterns of leadership skills required to be a digital leader.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you also touched on one point there about empowerment and this idea of, you know, Daniel Pink's stuff on sort of autonomy, mastery, and purpose. I mean, I think one of the things we see a lot of organizations struggle with on their DevOps transformation is this idea of, I'm going to create a multidisciplinary product team. They're responsible for that product from inception to retirement, from code commit to our running in production, and I'm going to give them a budget, and they're going to manage it. And I mean, is that a realistic goal for many organizations? Is that a step too far? I mean, you know, how do you see people struggling with that?
Yeah, a great question. I think absolutely yes. I think there are many examples of how certainly product orientation is far superior to project orientation, right? Where we shuffle developers around every 9 months, so they never get to see the downstream impacts of what they actually built. I think what I find fascinating is that there's a whole bunch of people now looking at this problem, whether it's people I admire, Mike Nygaard, who wrote the phenomenal book Release It, Mark Imbriaco, who was a former head of operations at GitHub and DigitalOcean and Heroku and Basecamp. Essentially, they're all looking at this problem of, like, now that we've fully empowered the teams, how do we make sure that we can get hundreds of teams to actually achieve a strategic objective, right? And that's really the domain of leadership. So, I think, there is this unaddressed problem that, Agile still leaves untouched. They say the team is the most important unit of work, but then how do you get the team of teams to really, succeed and win in the marketplace? And I think that is, that is by definition, that is a job of leadership.
Mm. Yeah, I think a lot of people, certain scaled Agile frameworks are a dirty word amongst my organization, but I think there is an element of like, traditional Agile doesn't really say a lot about your business case, doesn't really say a lot about how you get your funding, it doesn't say a lot about how, how certain things are incentivized and scaled up. And I think there's some of the challenges that the DevOps movement still has to face. I think there is a lot of criticism about DevOps is that, DevOps means anything to everybody. Do we need a DevOps framework? Is it too early to have a prescriptive framework? Do people just need to understand that we're on an evolutionary journey alongside these cloud technologies and these configuration management technologies? We're still finding our way.
Yeah, I've managed to sort of bypass that argument because...
very wise.
I think frameworks serve a very important purpose, right? When I saw the scaled Agile framework, that one diagram with the team owners and how you actually get them all to do joint planning and release planning, it was a huge aha moment for me because I recognized a problem that's intended to solve. In fact, had I known that at Tripwire 15 years ago, I would have said, we definitely have to do that because the absence of that was causing chaos that we only would recognize these kind of problems, in the last month of before a product was supposed to go out. The way I sort of bypass that argument is really, I don't really care so much about the exact processes of which we, achieve the outcomes. We really care about the outcomes, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think I've spent most of my time looking at, what are the outcomes that we want? The deployment frequency, deployment lead times, change success rate, mean time to repair, organizational performance, employee net promoter score, employee happiness. And then, obviously the architecture and the technical practices, we know that you need version control, you need automated testing, you need, environments on demand, we need proactive production monitoring. I mean, we know that, with certainty that those are required. Mm-hmm. And, so there's a lot of room there, to have frameworks that fit the organizational bent of the existing way that we work. So,
yeah, I think it's a bit like, if we look at the three ways, for example, as the equivalent of, some parts of the Agile manifesto, there are some key principles, and you just need to stay true to these key principles and be less hung up about the details. And, I think the more people put guidance out there maybe that's enterprise open source or inner source, or maybe that's, best practice on continuous delivery, best practice on these elements, you've now got this, you've got the ingredients and you've got a number of recipes, how you bring them together to create the DevOps cookbook is the original title of the handbook, how you bring those things together. I think that's also an interesting question for me about, you mentioned business outcomes. I see a lot of organizations, they're talking about their DevOps transformation, or they're talking about that they want to do DevOps. How can we do DevOps? Is doing DevOps the right objective, or is doing digital transformation the right objective? And DevOps is just the engine room of digital transformation?
You know, I don't know. In fact, a good friend of mine, Charlie Betts, who we've been having a professional collaboration that goes back almost 12 years. We met in the ITIL community, and you know, he put out a phenomenal textbook. So that's essentially really shows DevOps patterns, continuous delivery, how does that relate to project management and change management, and all the enterprise architecture. And one of the conversations that we had over drinks was, just like, what do you name this book? And he said, I think the final book that the title chose was Managing Digital Delivery. Okay. And, I guess, my comment to him was that that's not really a thing yet. And so we really called, we said our book was, the DevOps Handbook, just because it seems to, this is the term that we're just increasingly using to really talk about, how do we go from, idea to development into, through some sort of testing process, regardless of how it's done, to operations, to the customer, and ultimately win in the marketplace. And I think we're in a strange situation where we need to, as an industry, come up with a choice of how we describe it. Because we're all talking about, as you said, really managing the digital workforce. And I think the way I think about the problem these days is, IDC, the analyst firm, says there's 8 million developers on the planet, 8 million ops people on the planet. And I would say, by the most generous, wildly optimistic, leap, we can say, less than 1% of that population is using really DevOps patterns, getting DevOps outcomes. So the goal is, how do we get that to 100%? And that's not going to happen in the unicorns, right? That happens where the digital workers are, which is in the largest companies in every industry vertical. Whatever we call it, it's a big one. It's a big problem.
Yeah, I think I was rereading some of the handbook last night ahead of this call, and I was struck by there's a number of misconceptions out there. You get, on one hand, you get people calling for, there's no ops and the operations role is dead and we don't need operations people anymore. It's all going to be developer self-service, which is like some super unicorn developer that knows the Linux kernel as well as he knows Java or Ruby or something like that, or C#, and there's just some ridiculous misconceptions. And then I'm reading in the handbook about Etsy and what they had to do to get PCI compliance. Okay, Etsy's PCI compliance is a completely separate business unit that's on a completely isolated network that's completely separate from everything else, and is largely doing, not waterfall practices, but their release practices are heavily modified from what the rest of the business is doing. And I think it was a really important point to make, is that we don't have to throw ITIL away. We don't have to throw a lot of these frameworks and other things that we're doing away. We just have to adapt them as much as we can, whilst hopefully some of these broader compliance frameworks adapt. Do you think that people are rushing to throw the ITIL baby out with the DevOps bathwater, or?
Yeah, I think, that's so interesting. I mean, I think, yes. I can't remember the exact numbers, but, I think there's something like 3 to 4 million ITIL certified people out there. If you look at the Prince body framework, and the number's over 10 million people trained. And so those are the existing orthodoxies. And I say orthodoxy with no judgment. Orthodoxy just means that it is the incumbent way that we do work. And so, I think for any DevOps, for any technology leader, digital leader, whatever you want to call that, to not fully respect the existing orthodoxy is suicidal. And so for the transformational zealot, I think the ones who are succeeding are the ones who gain a certain mastery of the existing orthodoxy, so that they can recite chapter verse about the spirit and intent, as well as the actual procedures. That is, I'll always bet on the person who's able to do that than just go out there and say, ITIL or waterfall is wrong. Right now, we must have appreciation for the way we did things before and why we did things before, and be able to clearly articulate that I think that's really the savviness that's exhibited by, you know, people who are doing all these brave and courageous things, is that, you know, they have a certain political savvy to be able to do that.
Well, the example I always give when people come to me and say, oh, you know, ITIL's dead and we don't need ITIL anymore. Oh, so you're running your, you know, your large-scale multi-million pound e-commerce. Oh, so you don't do incident management. You don't do problem management. You don't do event management. You don't do release management. You don't do capacity management. Then what are you doing? Of course, you're still doing all those things. You're just ideally, you know, automating it. I always say, you know, DevOps is just ITIL with 90% of everything moved to standard change. It's pre-approved. It's ready to go. It's automated. It's known. It's low risk. Just go ahead and do it, and we'll save the heavyweight processes for the stuff that's, you know, really high risk. And there's always high risk.
And what a great point. I remember reading ITIL version 2 and just thought it was so groundbreaking. I thought it was just brilliantly done. And to me, there's a certain irony in the fact that as people move to, you know, say a private cloud model, Azure Stack or whatever, you know, essentially their job becomes capacity planning, right? I mean, they're working in spreadsheets and they're forecasting, and, you know, now that is ops work just as much as, restoring an outage. And forgive me, I have to leave in about 3 minutes. And by the way, thank you so much for that. I so much enjoy every interaction I have with you.
So I'm just going to wrap up with one question there about sort of DevOps in the Windows community. We've started our Windows, our WinOps community, partly because a lot of people felt they weren't getting what they wanted from the mainstream, the sort of Linux-focused DevOps community. What challenges do you think people face in the WinOps world or DevOps on Windows world?
There was a phenomenal post as part of the SysAdmin series of someone who came from the Linux world and now very much in the Windows world. And I just thought it was this brilliant article. And one of the things that he painted was that in the old days, some of the tooling just wasn't available, to help with automation. But, you know, I think that is certainly not the case these days, right, with the rise of PowerShell. The recent rise of PowerShell that only took 10 plus years in the making, the overnight success that was PowerShell.
Jeffrey Snover might have a few comments to make about that next time we see him.
It was one of my favorite talks was actually talking about the defenestration of Windows and just the savviness that he exhibited, integrating PowerShell into Exchange 2009. It's just phenomenal. I mean, I think, any notion that somehow the Windows world is at an inherent disadvantage for modern infrastructure or automation, I think is clearly outdated. In fact, I think there's a bunch of people whose opinions I respect, including the person who developed chocolatey packaging for Windows. Yeah. Yeah, he would say that it's actually Windows is an architectural advantage. I think if that's an objection that somehow Windows is not suited for automation in this new world, I think it's probably based on information that's probably at least a decade old.
Yeah, and I think that's a great message for our community that's watching the podcast. There's no excuses anymore. Learn Git, learn PowerShell, learn PowerShell DSC, learn Cloud, learn Azure, learn Azure templates, learn Terraform, learn Kubernetes, learn these open source tools. There's no excuses anymore. It's not just for the cool kids on the Linux side of the blocks. You have the tools now. You have the building blocks, and it's up to us to use those. And like Minecraft or use Lego, let's build something creative in the Windows world using that toolkit.
And just my last word to reinforce that, one of my favorite talks and videos available actually came from Jeffrey Snover in a talk that he did called "Surviving the Transition," which essentially really makes this heartfelt pleas, the days of the click next admin are coming to an end, and there are so many opportunities being made available. Take advantage of that. So with you, I wholeheartedly agree with your advice.
Fantastic. Well, on that note, I know you've got to go and so what time in the morning is it there? Is it like 8:35 or something?
Just 7:35.
I know you've got to go and take your kids to school. So thank you very much for taking your time out in the morning to come and talk to us. Always a pleasure. Hopefully we'll see you at the next DevOps Enterprise Summit or the WinOps in 20th and the 21st of September in London, the DevOps on Windows conference. WinOps will be here, so we might have to have a chat about getting you to come over and be part of that.
Would love to. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Gene.
Stephen, always a pleasure.
Take care, mate. Oh, thank you, everybody. Really fascinating conversation with Gene, as always. Going to take that out of my ear so I can hear now. Just to follow up for anybody who's interested in learning more about DevOps on Windows, obviously we have the WinOps community. It's at meetup.com/WinOps and winops.org. We have monthly meetups talking about all sort of Windows DevOps related topics, and we have our annual conference. Last year, our keynote speaker was Jeffrey Snover. You know, having a fantastic conversation around the DevOps application of Windows Server. We had Michael Green talking about release pipelines for infrastructure and how you can manage your infrastructure in a DevOps way, and a whole raft of other MVP and other speakers. All of the videos for those are available completely free on both Channel 9 and on YouTube. So just go and search for WinOps. WinOps this year will be in at CodeNode, Skills Matter in London on the 20th and the 21st of September. The first day will be workshops, and day two will be the traditional conference. You know, we're always up for guest speakers. If you have a DevOps transformation story that you want to tell, and if you have a DevOps question that you want to ask, you know, come along to these events, meet other people in your peer groups, and ask a question and share your experiences. I think it's really critical that we take this opportunity as part of the community to really sort of collaborate more, do more open source projects on GitHub, share our lessons learned, you know, all the way from our journey from ITIL to DevOps, our journey from waterfall to agile, or our, you know, our journey from doing things manually to doing things in an automated way. So yeah, you know, real call to action for anybody to come along. And without that further ado, pretty much I've run out of things to say, guys. So we're going to call it a day there. Thank you very much for listening. So you can tweet me at devopsguys.com or the ops manager, OPSMGR. If you've got any other questions or you want to follow up, or again, at WinOpsLDN to learn more about WinOps. Thanks very much.